Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Part of the argument that is being put out here about Dr. Ford's account is that doing it at this time is suspicious.
Frankly, all of that plays into some kind of a scenario that this is a political ploy, when what it is a person who has come forward with very serious allegations. And what's left for us to do is, what the heck are we going to do about it? Are we going to just dismiss it? Are we going to pay attention to it? You know, the thing about the Me Too movement is that unlike the environment in which Anita Hill found herself, this is a different environment. And people care.
Today's guest, Mazie Hirono, senator from Hawaii and a member of the Judiciary Committee, who months ago took a big step by refusing to vote in favor of letting any of President Trump's judges move forward for confirmation. And right now is at the forefront of leading Democrats' efforts on Brett Kavanaugh. You may know her from a speech she gave on the floor of the Senate around the Obamacare repeal vote last summer, talking about her own kidney cancer diagnosis and saying she wanted to see the same compassion her colleagues expressed to her be expressed in their votes on health care for others. You may know her for being the one who's made it a standard question for everyone who appears before her at a committee hearing, Kavanaugh included, to ask if they've been involved in sexual harassment and misconduct as a legal adult. Well, if you're listening to this, you know about the trouble that the Kavanaugh nomination is in right now because of the incident that a woman alleges to have occurred while they were both in high school. It's a story moving very quickly. So quickly, in fact, that we realized that the interview we recorded just a few days ago on Thursday, when the letter was known about, but the woman was still anonymous, needed some freshening up. So we went back on Monday to her office to record a little more, and what we're going to do is play that latest bit first, with her responding to the allegations and giving her sense of what's next, and then go back and play the longer interview from a few days before, which will give you a little more context of who she is and how she comes at all this. And you can read more on all of that in the story up on the Politico website, so please do. And please, make sure you're subscribing. Coming up for pretty much the total opposite direction on all this, I'll be sitting down with Ken Starr. And of course, email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com and follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. There's a lot to get to with Mazie Hirono, so let's get right to it. Let's just get right into it. What was your reaction to finding out about this letter?
Well, frankly, I was first read the letter last week when the Senate Democrats got together, but I did not have a copy of it, and the allegations were quite specific. The decision was that the matter should go to the FBI. Mm-hmm. So that was that. But significantly, Dr. Ford has come forward. And I think that if she hadn't come forward, the matter would still be with the FBI. And whatever they were going to do to investigate. But it's come forward, and I think it really changes the dynamics of how we're going to do this whole decision making with regard to Brett Kavanaugh. And he was set to have a vote this Thursday. And once again, I ask, what is the all-fired rush? This newest development, I think, as I say, changes the dynamics, and there are a lot of additional concerns being raised.
When you were read the letter, did you immediately believe it?
It was highly specific and believable. Reading the Washington Post article, though, there was an additional thing about she was willing to undergo, the FBI?
The polygraph, yeah.
So hers is a very credible account, and I believe her.
What do you make of the reaction that you've seen from others on this? Senator Cornyn from Texas has said this seems like a last-minute, unproven allegation.
I think it's really unfortunate for anybody to cast these allegations in that kind of light, because it just raises the memory that a lot of us have of Anita Hill and how she was treated. So, this shows a lack of understanding of how difficult it is to come forward with a story like this, and how much courage it took for Anita Hill to put herself through that, and certainly for Dr. Ford. She wanted all of this to remain confidential.
And already, we're just a day into this, and already people have gone through her teaching reviews, have gone
everything.
Through her court records,
yes.
That her family appeared before, yes. Judge Kavanaugh's mother.
Everything. Her life is an open book, and that's why to simply cast this as some sort of a political ploy. It shows a real lack of understanding of the dynamics of this kind of allegation.
Should Senator Feinstein have waited this long on the letter?
I think she did everything she could to maintain the confidentiality as requested. And even as of last week, when the rest of the Democrats in the committee, I don't think any of us cast aspersions on how she handled it. But at that point, it was time for the matter to go before the FBI, still maintaining, by the way, her confidentiality.
What I was told by that meeting with the Democrats on the committee was that there was some frustration voiced, maybe not by you, and certainly some frustration felt about Senator Feinstein not moving forward with this more quickly, which is interesting because part of the argument that is being put out here about Dr. Ford's account is that doing it at this time mm-hmm. is suspicious. So there were Democrats who last week felt like this should have been done earlier, actually, and had expressed that to Senator Feinstein.
Frankly, all of that plays into some kind of a scenario that this is a political ploy, when what it is a person who has come forward with very serious allegations. And what's left for us to do is, what the heck are we going to do about it? Are we going to just dismiss it? Are we going to pay attention to it? You know, the thing about the Me Too movement is that unlike the environment in which Anita Hill found herself, this is a different environment. And people care about these kinds of behaviors, and that there should be consequences, or certainly should be brought to light. And Judge Kavanaugh has denied it, and he has a lawyer.
Your question to him in the committee was, as a legal adult, mm-hmm. have you ever engaged in sexual misconduct? This is something that is alleged to have happened when he was 17. Mm-hmm. So he was not a legal adult. Does that change the nature of the answer to you?
Well, 17 is not exactly a baby either. So these are serious allegations. And she has a very credible story. And as I said, I believe her, and we now have to do more than simply say, well, look at the timing, and, well, it's just all political motivated. No, this has to be taken seriously. I asked the question based on them being a legal adult, and I will continue to ask my question in that way, because generally juvenile records are confidential.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that he lied to the committee then? Couldn't he? He says this incident didn't happen, but even if you accept that it did happen, his answer to you was, as a legal adult, no, that it would be nothing.
Well, certainly if it can be shown that he lied, that's even more troubling. So often in these cases, it does become he said, she said. But it's too often he said, she said, and that, therefore, victims hardly ever come forward, because they know that not only will they not be listened to, but they won't be believed. That's nothing new in the dynamics of this kind of behavior, by the way, and the victims who experience this kind of behavior.
You would not have anticipated, again, he says this didn't happen, but if he thought it did, if you had said, as a legal adult, have you participated in sexual misconduct? If he had said, well, not as a legal adult, but as a 17-year-old, he wouldn't have offered that information up to.
Of course not.
Right.
Of course not. And if, even if, as an adult, do you think any of them would actually say, oh, I did it? If they engage in this kind of behavior and they lie, they have to hope that nobody ever comes forward. That's one of the reasons that I think it's important to ask this kind of question, because sometimes these kinds of behaviors, as you can tell by CBS and all kinds of people, they have been engaging in this kind of behavior
for decades,
for a while, and people will come forward in this environment.
What does it make you think about the rest of the testimony that he gave before the committee?
Well, one of the other aspects has to do with this gag list that mm-hmm. Judge Kosinski had. He said he couldn't remember whether he was on this gag list or not. And
this is a judge who had to resign from the bench
because
many incidents of misconduct.
Well, 15, I believe, at some point, 15 women came forward, and over 30-year period, he had engaged in various sexual harassment and assault behavior. And Judge Kavanaugh said in all the time that he knew him, which was over decades, he heard nothing, saw nothing. And, but specifically though, this gag list group, I think that was pretty unbelievable that if he had gotten this kind of very explicit emails from Judge Kozinski, that he would not have remembered. But he said he didn't remember.
So do you think he lied to the committee?
Let's just say I'm going to ask him another question about that. It somewhat stretches credulity, let's put it that way. He said, I don't remember, so, you know, maybe he doesn't remember. But for most people, it would be kind of hard to get pretty explicit, sexually explicit materials, and you wouldn't remember. I think he didn't want to lie about it. So one way you get through that is to say, I don't remember.
Do you think he lied about the sexual misconduct? You believe the woman. Do you think he was lying in his testimony? The question you asked him was as a legal adult. Again, like that, you believe...
Well, I have no basis to think that he was lying when he responded to my question, that as a legal adult.
What do you make of the letter of all the people, all those women that went to high school with him, knew him, or they didn't go with him, they knew him in high school, 65 women who vouched for his character that came out as soon as... It became public that this letter was there.
I think we probably need to question 65 people. How well did they know him? I understand one of them was only in fourth grade.
Do you want to call 65 women before?
Well, some people are going to. I think that their efforts be made. I believe that, what is it, the Washington Post, somebody.
Politico.
Whatever. Yeah, I think it'd be kind of interesting to find out because.
And Politico called the 65 women, and so far, two have responded and say they stand by it.
Oh,
but
good
the rest
for them. I think it bears follow-up, let's put it that way.
So right now, do you think he should... You weren't going to vote for him to be on the court anyway.
I have plenty of reasons to be against his nomination and his confirmation. Plenty of reasons, based on the patterns that I identify, how he views... Well, reproductive choice for women, that's very clear to me where he stands on environmental laws and definitely with regard to indigenous peoples. Yeah. And the fact that there may be some effort to couch, you know, how he views indigenous people by saying, well, American Indians and Alaska Natives, you guys don't have to worry. We'll just shove the Native Hawaiians under the bus. We're free. That is not how it should work.
Do you think he will be on the court?
I don't know.
But it's more of a question now than it was last week.
Yes, I think it is more of a question.
If he's not, is there another Trump nominee that could get through the Senate?
There are plenty of people on the Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation list.
And what if the Democrats take the Senate in the midterms, which is something you're hoping would happen anyway?
I don't think we'd be looking to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation for people that we can support. Let's hope that the process will change to one where there's more of a meeting of the minds and that we could find someone who would garner more than the bare minimum of Republicans supporting this person. It's a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. So I hope that that will change, that dynamic will change, and we'll all be able to come up with something much more, somebody much more acceptable.
You think there's someone that President Donald Trump would nominate that, should there be a Democratic majority in the Senate, could be confirmed?
Surely there must be. Well, one of the people who got on the Ninth Circuit is someone that he probably got the fewest number of Republicans voting for him, and it was somebody from Hawaii. That's because he wasn't conservative enough.
We'll see if President Trump would nominate that person to the Supreme Court.
I don't think he wants to be. Well, I shouldn't say. But, you know, I just think that with all of the good judges that there are out there, that I don't mind a judge being conservative as long as I feel as though they don't have some kind of ideological axe to grind, which Trump appointees have.
Well, this would be a Trump appointee, right?
Yeah, but up to now, but there are a lot of conservatives who I think one could conclude that they can manage to be fair and apply the law.
I just wonder, we can leave it at this, it's possible that the Democrats are going to take the majority in the Senate. It's possible that Brett Kavanaugh's nomination is not going to make it through here. If it doesn't, it seems unlikely that another nominee would be able to be confirmed before the midterms at this point, just given where the timing is, right? You wouldn't support that kind of a rush on something, right?
No, I wouldn't.
So do you end up in a space then where if there's a Democratic majority, which there may or may not be, we could potentially have an opening on the Supreme Court that because of gridlock, because of an inability to agree, because of politics on both sides of it, is there for 2 years?
I think we've had those kinds of vacancies before, and we certainly had over a 1 year vacancy with Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
So the world does not come to an end because we don't fill all of the nominees. But as I said, my hope is that if Kavanaugh does not get confirmed, that there will be much more of a meeting of the minds, and that we'll be able to get back to an advice and consent process that will proceed the way it should, which also means that you're not going to have deemed committee confidential documents so deemed by one person and not even in a bipartisan decided way.
Yeah.
So I would like that kind of process to stop. You know, I'd like things to be a lot more open and more in a bipartisan fashion.
All right. Well, we have a lot of question marks that surround all of this.
Yes. So stay tuned.
We'll leave it at that. All right. And here's a longer interview, which we recorded in the same spot in her office a few days before. So why don't we start by talking about pottery?
Oh, well, we're starting with something that is very artistic and creative that keeps me on an even keel. Yes, it's one of the things I do.
Yeah, the right term is throw pottery, which to me sounds like how you break pottery, right?
That's only if you do wheel.
Okay,
throwing.
You don't throw?
No, I don't use a wheel. All of my things are hand built.
And what are you making?
Hand built. Well, I have some things here like that. Yeah. Piece of me hand built. I did the tray up there. That's called my Happy Pigs tray, and I did that sort of that figurine thing. So I do a number of things. But it's only hand built. I've done wheel throwing, but it drives me crazy.
Why?
It requires a lot of patience to get good at it. Mm-hmm. And while I took some lessons, I didn't have enough patience to get good at it. And also wheel throwing, unless you're really good at it, is too symmetrical for me. Mm-hmm. I like things to be a little askew.
And then there are the origami cranes too,
yes,
right? You've got it all over the office.
You know,
right?
One of the things that happened was because, as you probably know, I have some health challenges, mm-hmm. and a lot of people were saying that you should, you know, they wish me well. And I thought, here's something that people could participate in it. That's more than just your left brain usual stuff. And I thought part of my culture is to fold cranes. And when you fold 1,000 cranes, the kami-sama, the gods will grant your wish. So I thought that was a really good thing to do. And a lot of people got into it. So I've had 4-star generals, ambassadors, all kinds of people folding cranes. Many of them had never done anything like that before.
Do you fold other things in cranes? Because I feel like when people talk about origami, when I was a kid, I learned some stuff in origami beyond cranes. But now all I ever see is people doing cranes.
Well, I just fold cranes. And in fact, you can do it as a sort of a thing that you do while you're having a meeting. You know, I always have origami paper, and mm-hmm. my whole staff knows how to do it. But I
is
also
it a
do
requirement for getting hired, or
oh, it'd be nice. It doesn't take much to get to the, it's more the symbolism of it, doing something different. And I tell people, look, this is why diversity is important, because if I were not a member of the Senate, nobody would be folding cranes.
Yeah.
And also on the committee in that hearing, I would be the only one, and I was the only one to ask Kavanaugh about his views on Native peoples mm-hmm. and Native Hawaiians. I would be the only one who would pick out that document out of 190,000 committee confidential documents and deem it to be relevant.
I think that that's probably fair to say.
Yes.
I want to come back to Kavanaugh in a minute. Let's talk about how you got to where you are, but really how you got to America.
On a boat, truly.
Do you remember the boat?
Oh, of course. It was President Cleveland. I was almost 8, and I was seasick for much of the time. And, of course, I had never been on a big ship before. We came in steerage. Do you know what steerage is?
I do.
Okay, so that's how I came.
First class ticket all the way, right?
Oh, yeah, I wish. And so we literally had just one suitcase. And I'm sad that we did not keep that suitcase. My mother used it to store some documents and all that. And for some reason, it kind of left our house. But I would have loved to have kept it. But, you know, one of the things that I have on my wall to remind me, of course, as though I need a reminding, but, you know, where I come from is my naturalization paper document. It's the only thing that that is legal. I don't have a birth certificate or anything. But coming over here to a new country, it was a culture shock. I had...
You didn't speak English?
No, no.
And you came with your mother and your sister?
Right? My mother and my older brother.
Older brother.
Mm-hmm. So it was a huge... It was a huge change. And my grandmother had been raising me from age 3 to just before I came. So there were, I missed her tremendously. I saw her more than I saw my mother during that period. And so I understand things like family separation and what it does to a family. And we had to leave my younger brother in Japan because he was not old enough to go to school. And my mother would be working all the time and she needed two kids who could go to school.
And that must have been tough.
Yes, you know, it was very tough for her. Not,
and for you also?
Well, it was tough for my younger brother. The separation was very hard for him, and we did not know it at the time that it would have that kind of, in my view, lasting impact on him. And we're all different, so that's another thing I learned. While I was with my grandmother from age 3 to just before 8 years old, I responded to that separation in a very different way than my younger brother. My younger brother did not deal with it in the way I did. And I think part of it is that I'm very self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. I don't need a lot of people around me, although I chose kind of a strange thing to be doing in politics. But nonetheless, it was hard for my brother, and it had a lasting negative effect on him. And so I understand what separating children from their parents can mean.
You're the only senator who would have naturalization papers of the current senators.
Yes, of the current. I'm the only, immigrant serving in the U.S. Senate right now.
Do you think other senators, whatever party they're from, whatever background they're from, understand the immigrant experience?
I don't think the way I do, because there's nothing like firsthand experience.
Sure.
A lot of them come from an immigrant background, so you would think that they would understand, especially those that are only second generation, meaning that they were the first to be born in this country. You would think that they would have more of a recollection. But that is the sort of the greatness of this country, that in one generation you can move from being really poor, not speaking the language, to having an education.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm grateful for this country. My life would have been totally different
otherwise.
It seems
like also... growing up poor, there are not that many senators who really grew up like very poor. You were very poor.
Yes.
Up.
Well, we didn't have much. My mother made all my clothes. I don't remember having a new pair of shoes. I mean, it's not like I'm playing my violin or anything, but
no, it's the facts of the situation, right?
And so my mother, I know, qualified for welfare, but when she went in to get welfare, they looked at her and she told me they looked at her like she was dirt, and she walked out and said, "I will never go there."
They looked at her because she was dirt, or like she was dirt because she was.
She
was Japanese?
She was poor.
Yeah.
Poor
well,
people,
I assume
you know?
That in the welfare office, there are a lot of poor people coming in.
Yeah,
right?
And then you have workers who are not particularly empathetic or sympathetic. Mm-hmm. And she, having gone through all that she already did, she really got that vibe. And she said, "I'm not going to do this." And I don't fault anyone for receiving welfare, in fact, I always remember my mother saying that to me. And so my mother was very self-sufficient. She worked really hard, and... So that was me growing up, and I always felt very different from everybody else, even if I didn't talk about my background, but I felt very different from my classmates.
Was it hard to get to talking about your background?
In a way, yes.
You seem like a person who's somewhat private, somewhat introverted, and yet you've been in politics for coming on 40 years now.
Yeah. Oh, right? Has it been that long? I thought it was only like 30 years, but okay, yes.
Were you elected in 1980, right?
In 1980 was my first race, so I've been doing this for quite a while, and I'm grateful for it. But yes, I think that one can be in politics and still be quite private. And I don't need a lot of hoopla around me. I go about my business to get what I need to do, and I'm very focused on what I need to do. I have to say that this presidency has given me a lot more opportunities to be vocal and visible, and I think it's important. Now, I wasn't always this way, Isaac, because I come from a culture. I don't know. Have you ever been to Hawaii?
I have.
They're really, I mean, it's wonderful people, and I'm really glad for a culture that is much more supportive and kind and all of that. But we're also not a particularly verbal, confrontational culture. So, you know, and as an Asian person and as a woman, it's even more so. And as an immigrant. So, you know, I had a lot of reasons for being relatively quiet.
Yeah, I was
but
there.
But I had to kind of develop.
I covered the end of the primaries that your colleague Senator Schatz won, and that when Governor Abercrombie was lost his primary to Governor Ige, and it was striking how it's primary, so it's internal to a party, but still, it's a different thing—a primary in Hawaii, an election in Hawaii. It felt like then I came up covering politics in New York, where it's a little bit more confrontational.
Yes. Well, I've always had primary challengers, very strong primary challengers, and this is the first re-election that I haven't had, or election.
Yeah.
I haven't had a primary challenger, and so it's kind of nice. It's only taken me 35 years to get to this point, but I still don't take anything for granted. And, you know, my own experience, I hearken to my own experience as a sort of guidepost for the, what I work on and what I focus on. And I also say to a lot of people who think that they can't do a lot of things, you know, most of us have a comfort zone that we stay in, but all of us are capable of so much more in my own life. I tell people, you think I just kind of popped out like this? No. Over the years, I've really pushed myself to be expressive. I've always been very focused. I just didn't have to be very noisy about it.
And it is not your personality. You're not, right? You don't, it seems like despite being a politician, despite being a United States Senator, you don't run to the front of the crowd. You don't say, look and pay attention to my story, except now.
No.
You do.
I think it makes a difference to people who are struggling. And what impels me truly is that I've said to my staff for a long time now that there are people getting screwed in our country every single second, minute, hour of the day. And if by our work we can decrease that number, we'll make a difference. We'll be doing our jobs. And if I didn't have the kind of background that I had with a single mother who was just so focused on what she needed to do, I would not be sitting here today. If I were what I would call a typical middle-class kid, would probably not have protested the Vietnam War. You know, I come from a pretty non-confrontational culture. There weren't that many of my classmates from a big public school protesting the war, but I was one of those people. And it changed how I viewed government, and it led to my political involvement. So a large part of it is taking risks, getting out of your comfort zone.
Do you remember the decision to run for office the first time,
given
who you are, your personality at that point?
Well, by that time, I had been involved in politics, and I had run other people's campaigns.
Yeah.
All guys, by the way. And so one of them has decided.
And you're running
to
for state assembly, in Hawaii. Yeah.
He decided not to run for office, re-election. And he said, Maisie, you've been touting and having all of the rest of us running. Why don't you think about running? And I said, That's why I also, in my own life, I know that women respond to encouragement. And it's not as though we just say, hey, I'm just going to force myself on the unsuspecting public now. No, most of us feel like we have to have something more to offer, which is a barrier that guys do not face, by the way. They think that, as one of my staff members said, guys think they're God's gift to, you know, the world or something, and they can just run. But women, as a general proposition, we feel as though we need to prepare ourselves more. So before I ran for office, I had already been politically active for a decade. But it was very different being a candidate and not being a supporter. So
and saying, vote for me.
Yeah, well, that was a whole breakthrough. I remember knocking on somebody's door, and I forgot what I was standing there for. But I've since overcome that.
I would imagine you figured that out in between that and getting elected to the Senate.
It felt very weird to be the candidate.
Because you had to talk about yourself.
Yes, and to go and ask perfect strangers for their votes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It feels like then you talked about these questions, some of the questions you asked Judge Kavanaugh. And I think part of the reason why we wanted to do this podcast now is because of the role that you've taken on among your colleagues in the Senate, in the committee, the way that you think about how you question someone who is going to potentially be on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The thing that you had gotten known for was starting to ask everybody who came before you mm-hmm. if they had been involved in any
yes.
sexual misconduct or mm-hmm. assault.
Yes.
Or if they'd been disciplined for it. Nobody has ever said yes.
No.
Do you think any of them were not telling the truth?
I don't know. But if any of them did lie and somebody comes forward, then I think there will be consequences. And I hope that by asking these questions that it'll have an effect on people's behaviors, that I hope it has a deterrent effect on people.
Because why do you this think kind it of will?
Well, because you don't want to be caught lying
yeah.
under oath. And I think that's something that they now have to think about.
Do you think that someone who has committed sexual assault, if you're the type of person who has, is as concerned about lying about committing sexual
assault?
Well,
they can lie, but they better hope that nobody that they did this to will come forward. And we're now in an environment which is much more conducive to people coming forward. And that's why the Me Too movement is so important. And there's always a backlash and a reaction to that kind of thing. But where I come from is that women have been going through this kind of BS for what I say since time immemorial. I don't want this movement to be swept under the rug. And it's having an effect, the most recent being the CBS CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the person who does 60 Minutes.
Right.
You know, this kind of behavior should not be tolerated. And we're finally at the point where there are consequences.
Was it something that you had encountered along the way? Have you ever had an experience?
Of course. Every woman I know has had unwanted comments made. It doesn't matter whether you're pretty, ugly, or fat, or what. Unwanted comments are made about our appearance. And sure, I've had overtures.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had to just kind of ignore a lot of it. And so I would say every woman has had some level of unwanted attention.
Mm-hmm. But for you, it's overtures and comments. That's what you've had.
Yeah, nobody. Well, I did have a total stranger do what I would call an assault, and I was so shocked. I didn't even whoa. So
and
I know it happens.
Was
it
that?
Was a touching.
When
oh,
what
in a
happened?
Stadium?
In a stadium, like in Hawaii, or
yeah, in Hawaii. I'm just minding my own business, and some guy comes and touches me. Oh yes.
I will admit that as a man, that's not something that's happened to me. What is that goes through your head at that moment?
I was shocked. And then, but he just walked by me, and so it happens.
I mean,
this kind of thing.
I when everything started to become more in the forefront on Me Too a year ago now, I had a conversation with my wife, and I said, "Is this happening to you?" And she said, "Yeah, like on the subway and mm-hmm. whatever." It'll, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There is a. It seems like a. What had been an almost acceptance among women that this was part of the world, not a comfortable, like, mm-hmm. not happy about it,
mm-hmm.
but no, yeah, this is what happened. And for a lot of men, just an absolute obliviousness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Obliviousness. But I'm hopeful that now with the Me Too and people coming forward that this kind of behavior thrives in an environment mm-hmm. where there's obliviousness. You don't see anything, hear anything, say nothing.
Yeah.
And that has to change because it's not just the perpetrator who needs to be stopped. It's the people all around who should be noticing certain things happening. And so that's part
of the
change.
Did you have any experiences with it as an elected official? You've been an elected official for a long time. People who knew you were...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, but not here.
Not here, but in Hawaii?
Yes.
People who knew you're an assemblywoman, you're the lieutenant governor, and nonetheless.
Yeah, my colleagues would hit on me. So
colleagues in the legislature.
Yes.
And what do you do in that circumstance?
I ignore it. Or sometimes I'll just say something so cutting that they never tried anything. Actually, I'm kind of a, I may be quiet. People may think I'm quiet, but I'm very ferocious.
Yeah.
I scare people. Yeah. I'll just look at them and say, well, anyway, it's enough.
It's hard on a podcast to capture the look that you just gave
them. Me. You know, it's like, don't, you know what, with her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. No, I was not a pushover.
It seems like
I remember one time. Okay, I'll tell you a story. One of the really powerful people in the house, and he's since passed, but everyone used to suck up to him, but not me. And he would use what we call racially insensitive or anything, but there's something called the Filipino love call.
I don't know what that is.
You go psst, psst, like that. To somebody.
Okay.
So this person sat behind me, and this is in the state legislature. I'm sitting there, and he would do this, and I would never respond. And finally, I turned around and I said, I don't respond to that. And he said, what do you respond to? I said, try Maisie. He never did it again. So,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
That seems like it would be an effective way to shut somebody like that down.
Yes. Uh huh. And it was.
And then the word gets around, I guess, and don't come at Maisie with the...
Well, because I will say something. I am not a pushover. Either I'll totally ignore whatever messages, or if they're overt about it, I will definitely say something.
What do you make of what... We're a year into also when there was a conversation that got started in Congress because of the members of the House and Al Franken, who resigned under pressure, under all the allegations being made. But there has not been a bill that has come together from the House and the Senate on sexual harassment. We had Senator Gillibrand on the mm-hmm. podcast in the spring, mm-hmm. who was talking about how she thought, okay, it's about to happen. I said, we've heard that before. And she said, no, I think it's really now. We're into September now. Is anything going to happen?
I've just recently talked with her about it, and we have not forgotten. Just as the women members on the Senate Armed Services Committee, we do not forget anybody who comes and testify before us now. They need to be prepared to respond to the question of, so what's happening with sexual harassment mm-hmm. and assault in the military? And what's happening with the retaliation? We know that's still going on. So, you know, other things have come to the fore that we have had to deal with. But I recently talked with Kirsten. I said we do need to change how we approach or the kind of environment we create in our own, in Congress for reporting
these
kinds of...
What do you do? I mean, it's a year of not moving.
So... As in anything, you need some spark plugs to move things along. And I will continue to. I'll work with Kirsten because they say we can't let this just fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
And we need to confront, in my view, because I remember when it all was happening and Mitch McConnell says, oh, well, you know, and this was, in my view, very sexist. He said the women, something along the lines of the women senators will come up with some changes, appropriate changes. Well, we have come up with some changes. So he needs to face up. Yeah. To making the you know, having the bill come to the floor.
It's this weird thing where you and Senator Gillibrand and others who you sort of need the women to be pushing on this, but this idea that like, well, the women will like, we'll let them deal with that. Like, and is that it's an issue that it's a women's issue and not an issue for all of Congress.
Well, believe me, right? When Mitch McConnell framed it that way, I thought this is part of the problem. But none of us is a shrinking violet. So...
No, I don't think that you'd say that about any senator, actually.
Yes, and none of the women who get here.
Certainly.
So we will be, my hope is that we will get that back on track and we will move things along. Just as Kirsten was such a big part of making some changes to the military justice to really push that, and she really stayed the course. That's what we need to do.
So let's talk about those Kavanaugh hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like your colleagues have approached them in the way that you'd want?
Which colleagues? My own? The Democrats or the Republicans?
Well, because they're busy. Let's take them. I guess you see them as separate questions. Do you think that the Republicans have approached them in the way that you'd want?
No, of course not.
What would you have wanted?
Because they have been very busy trying to deny the availability of documents that we should get. And for them to say, oh, well, it's millions of documents, that's not relevant. That's not the relevant issue. The quantity is not the issue. It's that we should have access to them. As I said, my document that I used was among 190,000 pages.
And it was an email, and
it was
you know, it was not something that would have been at the top of, nobody would have said, oh, well, we have to make sure this document comes through. You found it because you were looking through the documents, right?
I think it was recognized that I would be interested in that. But the bigger question is, why should that document even have been deemed confidential?
Right.
So certainly I completely disagree with how the document question and the but they are proceeding. And of course, we start with the fact that Mitch McConnell wouldn't even give the courtesy of anything to Merrick Garland. So it's not like we have to revisit, you know, there are these things about, oh, but they're still relitigating the 2016 election. Oh, no, just shut up, you know. We're not doing that. We have a nominee in front of us, and we want to do our jobs and reviewing all the documents that we should have access to. So I very much disagree with how the Republicans are going about it. And for my part, I sought to find a pattern to his decisions, and he's written 300 decisions. He's written a lot of really interesting articles about his perspective on executive powers. And so I wanted to find a pattern, and I did.
What's the pattern?
And the pattern is on certain issues, on environmental issues, for example, he will narrowly interpret a Cleaner Act, a Clean Water Act, if the litigants, one is a corporation and the other is some, you know, public interest group or something like that. And he'll go with he will narrowly interpret laws that are meant to protect health, safety, and welfare of our people. So on environmental issues, I think there's recognition that he's on the side of the polluters. Then with regard to reproductive choice, it's very clear. So even if he says that Roe v. Wade is pretty settled, what's going to happen is that he'll be among those that decide all of the state laws that will be enacted. Hundreds have already been enacted that limit a woman's right to choose. So he'll be there to vote for all these limiting laws. And Texas will be probably at the forefront in churning out these kinds of state
legislation. They have been so far.
Yes.
That's what people complain about is the kabuki of these hearings always, right? That he says, well, settle precedent or whatever. But everybody knows that he would not have been.
No, that's why
And whatever you think of the abortion issue, mm-hmm. Brett Kavanaugh knows that known about him that he thinks that abortion restrictions should be in place and does not think that Roe v. Wade is where the law should be, right? He would not have gotten to the president's desk. The president would not have nominated him.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that's true, by the way, Barack Obama, the reverse was true. Lana Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor said, everybody knew where they were on that issue. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten nominated by Barack Obama.
Yes, but I'm for people who actually want to expand our protections, individual protections. I'm for people. This is not a sort of equivalency.
No. It's not an equivalency. When any judge sits before the Senate Judiciary Committee on a confirmation hearing like this, and we pretend that what's precedent, what's not. On that issue, their views are known by the people who nominate them.
Yeah,
right?
So when they say they're going to follow precedent, it's just totally, it doesn't even compute with me anymore because they're all primed to say that, and then they get on especially on the Supreme Court, and I've watched Judge Gorsuch.
Yep.
And one of the first things he did was overturn a 41-year-old case. So when
you're
they say
about
those things,
the Janus case.
Janus
right?
case.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of that is pretty meaningless. So what we are left
is
their writings.
Yep.
What did they say? I'll look at their blogs, and we draw our conclusions based on all of that information because they are primed to tell us very little.
Yeah.
But yet, it is an opportunity for us to raise all of these issues and to question them about when you wrote this and all of that. We don't expect them to say, oh, you know, sorry. They do. They say what they say, and that's why we draw the conclusions we draw, that these are not moderate people.
What end does that accomplish? If we're in a situation where it looks like most of the votes in the Senate were basically decided on Brett Kavanaugh mm-hmm. the day that Anthony Kennedy announced mm-hmm. that he was resigning, right? The most Democrats, most Republicans decided, okay, I'm going to vote against him for him.
Mm-hmm.
And the hearings are full of non-answers from the nominee, what do you really accomplish with
this? What we accomplish is letting the American people know that I frame this as part of a concerted effort on the part of the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation to pack our courts. And they've been doing this for decades now, preparing the way, and they now have a willing president who's going to pick names off their list. So the American public needs to know that court packing is going on. I talk about it in that way, and that elections matter. So a lot of the laws that will protect individual rights, et cetera, will have to come from, at this point, from the state level. So it matters who they elect. And I hope to enable everybody to connect the dots, mm-hmm. that they better be voting at the state legislative level and the governorships for people who are going to provide the kind of protections that maybe they will no longer be able to expect from the Supreme Court. So that's part of it. But also to understand that court packing is going on and that our rights are being subverted big time, as far as I'm concerned. And so it's an education, awareness, responsibility that we have.
You were on the issue of the judges for months before Kennedy announced that he was leaving the court,
yes.
before Kavanaugh was nominated. Mm-hmm. And I asked you how you felt about how your colleagues had approached all this. When you talked about your Republican colleagues, do you think your Democratic colleagues have been on edge about judicial nominations in the way that you'd want them to be enough?
I know that I have been talking about court packing for a long time, and all my constituents who come to see me, whether it's a program that supports, you know, food, whatever it is, I say, you know, that all of the issues that you care about will be impacted by the courts, because a lot of the president's actions will be challenged, or as the case may be. And so it all is connected. So I've been talking about court packing for a long time. I think somebody like Sheldon Whitehouse has also mm-hmm. spent time on
the senator from Rhode Island.
Yes. Yeah. On court packing. And so, you know, he and I, we share those kinds of perspectives. I think just as it's taken decades for the Federalist Society and these really conservative groups that funded, by the way, the Janus case mm-hmm. and the predecessor Frederick's case, that they are there to fund these kinds of cases to change as one law professor put it, to change how they view government and the protections that government should afford. So these are huge, you know, changes that can occur. And I think it's really important for us to let people know that just as these conservative groups have spent decades, we have to be willing to spend decades thinking about and acting in ways that will prevent more of these people from getting into the pipeline.
I mean, it seems like some of your Democratic colleagues have been reluctant to blow up the process more along the way here. That there was a sense among the Republicans that when they didn't move on Merrick Garland, even though I know from conversations I was having with some of them at the time, other journalists were having with other senators, some of them were uncomfortable with what mm-hmm. was going on, but they decided they were going to do it. It was a political play.
They hold their noses a lot.
Yeah.
Sadly.
And then what you've seen among some Democrats is, should we try to get back to sort of a regular order on this? Should we try to restore this? And there is this other tension within the Democratic Party that says, no, the Republicans blew up the process. It's not going to ever be the same. Let's not try to pretend that it is. And you got to act in that way. You seem to be in that latter group that says, no, we're going to fight hard here.
Yes.
So what do you say to your Democratic colleagues who say,
this is why I don't bang them over the head about some of the things that I do. As you know, I vote against cloture for all judicial nominees because I very much object to how the committee is dealing with blue slips and the fact that they're just piling on all of these people, cramming the agenda. So I do that. But I don't expect my other colleagues to do that. I figure they have to figure it out for themselves. If that's how they want to proceed, then they should do so. So there are a lot of things where I really do respect the individual decisions. Now, I'm an advocate, so I will advocate for particular bills, mm-hmm. et cetera. I will do that. But there are certain things that I expect my colleagues to be able to figure it out and act accordingly.
Yeah.
So there's that. So I am far less reluctant to say what I want to say.
I take it you wouldn't agree with President Trump's account of what happened, that there were all these judicial openings because President Obama forgot to nominate people to them.
Please. He just lies every single day. Facts do not matter. No, that there were a lot of Obama nominees that never got the time of day, even the ones that came out of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah. So I mean, factually, that's not correct. Yeah, so, as someone who covered many of those nominations as they were happening, there were a lot of attempts to get people on the court by the Obama White House.
Yes.
And it didn't work.
Yes. That's because we actually abided by the blue slip process and things like that.
Right. Well, that's the argument, right? Mm-hmm. So forget about the blue slip process. And forget about the blue slip process is the process by which if a senator in each state can essentially hold up judicial nominations for that state.
You try to work things
which sounds like
out.
It's such an arcane, the dignified rules of the Senate that can even happen. I think most people don't even know that that's something that was the routine.
The practical effect of the blue slip process was to get us to talk to each other and to try to come up with a candidate that people could support.
But those days are done?
Apparently so.
Justice Roberts, when he was before the committee, famously talked about, for his confirmation hearings, talked about being an umpire, calls balls and strikes. Mm-hmm. With what you've seen, the pattern that you were talking about with Judge Kavanaugh, is he an umpire, calls balls and strikes?
No. He knows where he needs to be and he gets there. And what's astounding to me, and I will give the example of the Royce v. Cayetano case because that's one that I'm familiar with since it involved Hawaii. But he argued in—
Cayetano, of course, the governor.
Governor, who was at that time the governor.
That you did not really get along with when you were—
Well, I got along fine with him, but what the heck. I'm still here, you know? So anyway, I was—
He happens to be the named plaintiff in this case.
Yes, I was lieutenant governor at that time. But what was astounding to me is that Judge Kavanaugh filed an amicus brief as well as contemporaneously a Wall Street Journal article that was full of non-facts. And I think it's astounding to me that somebody would go before the Supreme Court and use those kinds of arguments to convince the court. And that's why... when I attended that hearing, I mentioned at the Kavanaugh hearings, I was really surprised that the Supreme Court, so many of the Supreme Court justices kept trying to think of Native Hawaiians as somehow set up as tribes. And I'm thinking, why are they asking all these questions? It has nothing to do with it. Can they not understand that there are some places that are constituted as monarchies? Hey, Great Britain, king, you know, that's what we had. But I can see why they might have ask those kind of questions, because guess what? That was what was in the Kavanaugh brief. And then he misstated the holding of the court under oath in his hearings.
Is that a mistake, do you think?
Oh, please, how can you go to the Supreme Court and misstate a holding? That's like first year law school stuff. And then he misapplied the holding, misapplied the law.
And in that exchange that you had with him, you asked him about what he was thinking with an email he said to you. I don't know. That email was 15 years ago, or whatever he said. However many years ago it was, 16 years ago. I can't remember what I was thinking at that time. That doesn't do anything for
you. I know exactly what he was thinking. He was thinking a certain way about indigenous peoples and Native Hawaiians. And there are still a lot of people who think that way around here, by the way. They think Native Hawaiians, that's just a racial group. So that any bill that has the words Native Hawaiians is subject to strict scrutiny and probably unconstitutional. I get that all the time here because we have a lot of, you know, we like to reauthorize Native Hawaiian housing, education, healthcare, three really important bills. And there are a lot of Republicans, particularly in the House, who think that anything relating to Native Hawaiians is unconstitutional. And you know what? They cite the Rice case. And I say, that is not the case for that proposition. But guess what? Kavanaugh under oath.
If Judge Kavanaugh becomes Justice Kavanaugh, what does that mean? What do you think that does?
It's not good for indigenous peoples because there were very well-financed groups that funded the Rice lawsuit. And there was a time when there were a lot of challenges to Native Hawaiian programs, including we have a school called Kamehameha Schools, and there was a challenge to their admission policy. So there were these outside groups that funded these kinds of challenges. They're still around. And so with Judge Kavanaugh and his articulated position that these kinds of laws should be strictly scrutinized, and of questionable constitutional validity, it just invites. That's like a big fat notice. That's what led to the Janus case, where you have Alito letting it be known for 6 years. We really should look at the Abboud decision. This is why these plaintiffs were found. Frederick's and Scalia died, so it's 4-4.
So
Gorsuch is on the court, and wham, you know, he votes the other way, and 41-year-old precedent is overturned against unions.
All right, so last question. Let's say in the Judiciary Committee, you might have another opening that you guys will consider if there's an opening for Attorney General. Do you think that Jeff Sessions should stay as Attorney General?
I did not vote for him.
I'm aware.
At the same time, you know, it matters the motives of the president, and the motives of the president is to try to interfere with the Mueller investigation. And so the president is going to do whatever he does. I am hardly the person that's going to be protecting Jeff Sessions, because he's been doing a lot of things that have to do with consent decrees with police departments and watching the you know, voter suppression laws and all of that. So, and he's really bad on immigration. So he's totally on the page in terms of separating children and all that. To the extent that the president is doing this to try to stop the Mueller investigation, that's not a very good reason for me. But I'm not going to go down in flames.
Yeah, so you wake up in the morning and you get a breaking news alert on your phone that says Jeff Sessions has just been fired by President Trump.
I would redouble my efforts to protect the Mueller investigation.
Do you think the Senate Judiciary Committee would consider another nominee?
Both the chairman and and Lindsey Graham have said as much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is why votes matter. Elections matter.
It does seem like we might know the answer to this question soon after the midterms, depending on how things go, or maybe not depending on how things go. The president has kind of kicked the ball to there for now. It's a very strange thing to think that we all kind of in Washington assume that the attorney general is not long for his post, or the president will just keep threatening him and making fun of him on Twitter and not actually fire him.
At this point, you know, whatever the president does is whatever the president does. He's unpredictable. He is he only thinks about his self-protection every day, all the time, every minute. And that's where he comes from. And the fact that so many Republicans continue to enable him to keep going is astounding to me. And they obviously are not at the point where they're going to say, this is not good for our country. But they're not at that point yet.
Senator Mazie Hirono, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Is she right about her approach to Kavanaugh, to what the Judiciary Committee hearings are being used for and should be? Were you surprised to hear her say she'd be ready to hold the Supreme Court seat open for 2 years if needed? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to follow me on Twitter @IsaacDover. And catch you next time on Off Message.